Like the man said, you are listening to WHPC 90.3 FM, Garden City, New York, Nassau Community College. And since it is Friday at 5 p.m., that means you are listening to American Hit Radio. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, with a speech impediment. Thank God Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, is here with me to keep me on track.
I'm going
to
kick you in the shin.
Every time I lose my place.
Yes. Something. Or mess up a word.
What if I'm having trouble? Maybe I'm having trouble concentrating today. I'm not sure what that is. Well, I do know that on Fridays, of course, we call the show How Music Changed. I remember that. And I also remember that we're in the middle of a series of programs dedicated to the Rolling Stones. We've been playing their entire officially released catalog in chronological order, more or less chronological order. And we're getting close to the point where we're going to start skipping through a little bit more quickly than we have been. We're not going to play everything all the way to the end, but we will be covering their entire career. But where we left off last week, we started playing the album, Let It Bleed, and we got pretty well into it. We played most of the first side and a significant part of the second side even. There's just a few tracks left, so that's where we'll pick up. What I want to do, though, is I want to read a review of the album, because I've been using this book as a reference called The Rolling Stones Illustrated Record. And they have some interesting information in their reviews. Obviously, they're very opinionated. Some that you may or may not agree with, but I think you'll at least find it interesting. Well, here's what they've got to say about the album, Let It Bleed. If Beggar's Banquet branded the Rolling Stones lords of misrule, then Let It Bleed truly nailed them in the public's eye as self-styled princes of darkness. Not so much another album, but a collection of vignettes depicting the Stones faithfully playing out their accepted roles as vandals, outlaws, and satyrs. As with Beggar's Banquet, it takes just two tracks to cast the die. Gimme Shelter, a straight reworking of Under My Thumb, which is odd, I never thought of that until I read it, and then I'm like in my head, like, oh yeah, similar, you know, chord structure or whatever.
Huh.
Anyway, is, due to the timing of the album's release, regarded as the theme song for the tragedy of Altamont. What actually happened, you see, Altamont did occur on December 6th, 1969. This album was released in December of 1969, obviously recorded well before that point. However, something needs to be clarified. Altamont could have happened to almost any band of the Stones' stature. Sadly, the growing paranoia that had been mainlined into the youth culture insisted that whatever happened out there on that speedway track was some kind of invocation of the dark powers of evil over which the Rolling Stones had absolutely no control. Altamont was to be Woodstock West. Instead, it was Paradise Lost. Bad acid, lack of organization, congestion, dehumanization, and sudden death reflected the cataclysm of instant mashed America that the counterculture was trying to reject. By nightfall, when the Stones hit the stage, all was lost. The audience was so bombed out, so uptight, so utterly confused, it's a wonder the Stones themselves weren't sacrificially slaughtered. Midnight Rambler not only further consolidates the imagery of sadomasochistic Mick, it dubbed him everybody's Lucifer due to his predilection for reenacting the role of Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler. Even Jagger went to the extent of incorporating Salvo's exact words when confessing to his most vicious crime, the rape and murder of 23-year-old Beverly Sammons. The remainder of the album is almost tame in comparison as it reminds familiar themes. However, this isn't meant as a criticism. The Stones' penchant for serious dues-paying blues is further exemplified with Love in Vain, which replays the same characteristics of Prodigal Son and No Expectations. Live With Me is typical strident hardcore sleaze, while the title track is a knockabout hip-shaker that throws new light on the invitation in that it offers, among other things, coke, not tea, and sympathy. Now, we've heard all of those tracks up until this point. One more paragraph here. Though Keith Richards sang the first verse on Salt of the Earth, Beggar's Banquet, the understated country love song, You Got the Silver, marks his solo debut, and it is the only song to have been chosen for the soundtrack of Zabriskie Point. Let's stop and play that song right now, hearing Keith sing an entire song for the first time on vinyl with the Rolling Stones. Here's You Got the Silver.
Hey, babe, why what's in your eyes. I saw them flashing like airplane lights. You fill my cup, babe, that's for sure. Must come back for a little more. You got my heart, you got my soul, you got the silver, you got the gold, you got the diamonds from the mine. Well, that's alright. It'll buy some time. Kitchen door.
The soul of the band, Keith Richard.
There you go.
Singing that song there, of course. That's You Got the Silver. And we're picking up on a little bit, I want to say the end of Side 2, because that's not exactly true, of course. Side 2 only had 4 songs on it. So we played the first track, Midnight Rambler, last week. So we're just picking up there as we're moving through it.
Right.
Now, that review goes on for just really one more short paragraph. Which reads this way. The fact that the Stones themselves insist, quote, "Well, I hope we're not too messianic or a trifle too satanic. We love to play the blues," unquote, is sufficient evidence that one mustn't always take the Rolling Stones at face value. And did you know that this album was originally going to be called Sticky Fingers? How about that? I did not know that.
Oh.
Well, the track that supplies the lyrics that ends the review right there is this song. It's probably the song that gets played the least on the entire album. And yet it's a pretty darn great song. Here's Monkey Man.
Thank you. from. He's pretty awesome. It. Right. At Living There from Mick Jagger on that track, proving, you know, to Keith, hey, I'm the lead vocalist in this band. You know, as far as, like, you know, it goes, I mean, there's really no song on an album as great as Let It Bleed that you could say is obscure, but I think you could honestly say that that track does get the least amount of airplay. It's the one that you might be able to surprise a new listener with who might be a friend of the Stones. They might, oh, I don't know that one.
Mm.
Keith was talking about singing, actually, a little bit in his book, about that track in particular. In one paragraph, I'll read it. Gimme Shelter and You Got the Silver were the first tracks we recorded in Olympic Studios for what became Let It Bleed, the album that we worked on throughout the summer of 1969, the summer that Brian died. You Got the Silver was not the first solo vocal I recorded for the Stones. That was Connection. But it was one of the first ones I wrote entirely by myself and laid on Mick. And I sang it solo simply because we had to spread the workload. We'd always sung harmony like the Everlys. Well, not exactly. So it wasn't as if I'd suddenly started to sing. But like all my songs, it never felt like my creation. I'm a damn good antenna to pick up songs zooming through the room, but that's all. Now, regarding the last song on the album, I would say that definitely qualifies as the most produced song ever released by the Rolling Stones. You Can't Always Get What You Want, which being the track. For a while, I know that my son Kyle picked this as one of his favorite all-time songs. Probably one of mine as well. The one thing I've got to be careful is that I'm not overly exposed to it because you still hear it a little bit too often on classic radio stations. But I don't want to let that diminish the awesomeness of the track. I'll let Keith have the last word before we play the song. You Can't Always Get What You Want was basically all Mick. I remember him coming into the studio and saying, I've got this song. I said, you got any verses? And he said, I have, but how is it going to sound? Because he'd written it on guitar, it was like a folk song at the time. I had to come up with a rhythm, an idea. I'd float it around to the band and just play the sequence here and there. And maybe Charlie decides which to go for. It's all experimentation. And then we added the choir on the end, very deliberately. Let's put on a straight chorus. In other words, let's try and reach them people up there as well. It was a dare, kind of. Mick and I thought it should go into a choir, a gospel thing, because we'd play with black gospel singers in America. And then, what if we got one of the best choirs in England? All these white, lovely singers, and do it that way. See what we can get out of them. Turn them on a little bit. Get them into a little sway and a move, you know? You can't always. It was a beautiful juxtaposition, which is true, and it was. And I think a really big key here, actually, a lot of credit needs to be given to Jimmy Miller, who's the album producer, because it's actually Jimmy Miller who's playing drums. And the thing that really propels this song is that really incredibly great skip rhythm that he plays, which you really didn't hear anybody playing a drum beat like this up until this point. And it's sort of like it's common usage. It's a type of thing that I'll throw into a song all the time now if I want to give it a sense of something that gives it something more of a propulsion, because you'll feel it like literally trying to skip its way forward. And it really, I think it's awesome. It's great. Anyway, here's You Can't Always Get What You Want.
The reception, glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find. Get my fair share of abuse. Singing words gonna vent our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50 amp fuse. Sing it to me. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You just might find you get what you need. Oh, baby, yeah. Oh. I went down to the Chelsea drugstore to get your prescription filled. I was standing in line with Mr. Jimmy. Ill. We decided that we would have a soda. My favorite flavor, cherry red. I sung my song to Mr. Jimmy. Yeah, and he said one word to me, and that was there. I said to him, you can't always get what you want. Just might find. You get what you need. Oh, yeah.
December 1969. What a soundtrack we had for our lives back at that point in time when you think about it. It's just, I don't think there's ever been anything quite like that in terms of being able to repeat it. I mean, music wasn't just something that
you
listened.
Well, if you were in our summer party, we repeated it.
What was that?
We did this song at our summer party.
Well, that was only, yeah, but I mean, I'm talking about to really be, repeat anything where music would ever be that important in anybody's life ever again. I mean, of course, music matters now. People hear music. Everybody's, you know, you like what you hear. But in 1969, at this point in time, the youth culture, I mean, music was life defining. It was it was more important than movies, TV, sports. It eclipsed
everything.
That's
how you chose your friends.
It was like really like it was the defining.
If they like what you like.
Point of culture. Yeah, it's how you did, really. It's the thing that bonded us together as a generation. There's an excerpt in here from the special release version of their next album, which was a live album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, which I'm going to go right into playing tracks from that. But I'm not going to play the actual Get Your Ya-Ya's Out album yet. The special release version that came out had an extra disc with additional tracks that weren't on the album. So we'll start with those, and which will probably mean next week we'll be able to save most of the actual live album for next week.
Okay.
But there's a very interesting short essay here, at least the beginning of it, which I'd like to read because I think it captures some of the ideas of what I'm trying to say about what I was just trying to convey about the times. The Rolling Stones' Madison Square Garden concerts in November of 1969 might very well have been, at least for the 1960s, as good as it was ever going to get. The Stones' performances came at the end of an unprecedented ascendance of music's influence over an entire generation. It is probably fair to say that never in the history of America had music played a more important role than our music did for us. And the most extraordinary music it was. The Stones' 1969 tour was the latest wave of the so-called British invasion, which stood on the shoulders of American rock and roll, back to Little Richard, Chuck Berry, and American blues before that. The British invasion revitalized an American rock and roll that had grown soft and fluffy until Bob Dylan's rocket-fueled lyrical, social, and electrical revitalization, some say reinvention, of it all. There was no reason for those assembled in Madison Square Garden to believe that we, with our music, wouldn't continue on our heady course upward and rise ever higher, a word with a lot of currency at the time. But you never know. The Rolling Stones tour launched on the West Coast less than 3 months after the festival at Woodstock. Those who were at Woodstock, as well as those whose sympathies were aligned, a much larger number, were famously dubbed the Woodstock Nation, in a phrase attributed to Abbie Hoffman, a Yippie activist. Hoffman would come backstage before the Chicago concert to visit Mick and the boys, try to borrow money.
Oh, boy.
Be rebuffed and wander out muttering, bunch of cultural nationalists. It was a clever phrase, Woodstock Nation, grouping us as it did into a political and social entity as if we had power. Nations had their own armies, right? And national anthems?
Gave you clout.
Well, certainly no nation ever had a soundtrack like ours. 1969 was an extraordinary year, and there can be no doubt about it. Now, in the 40th anniversary, we have reason to remember it. The Rolling Stones in Hyde Park on July 5th, prior to Woodstock, the largest of the mushrooming free concerts. July 21st, the landing on the moon. August 15 to 17, Woodstock. And although unknown at the time, the last Beatles performance, to name a few. In that year, a barrage of unbelievable albums was released as rock and roll continued to peak. A writer in December of 2003 would recall late December 1969 the, quote, greatest week in rock history, citing Billboard chart at the time, which had in its top 10 the Beatles' Abbey Road, the Rolling Stones' Let It Bleed, Led Zeppelin's Led Zeppelin II, Santana's first album, Blood, Sweat, and Tears album, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, not listed, perhaps, just because they didn't have albums out that month, were Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, The Doors, and Jimi Hendrix, all active at that time. Well, that essay is by Ethan Russell. The tracks that I want to play now, at this point, what the Stones would do is after they would like come out and do their electric introduction, they would mellow down a little bit. The band would sort of wander off stage to relax.
Mm-hmm.
Keith would sit down on a stool. Mick would wander up and sit next to him, and they would become just really a blues duo. With Keith playing
kind of like
some,
them sitting in the living room, in their own living room, almost.
Yeah, it's
just,
essentially what you would say about what an unplugged would be. Mm-hmm. They were doing it at this point in time in the
way
middle of their show. Now, these tracks that I'm going
to
play here did not make the Get Your Ya-Ya's Out Live album, but I still think that they're very interesting to hear. So we'll play a couple of them right now back to back. Here's a Prodigal Son and You Got to Move.
Thank you very much. We sure gonna dig it. Can you dig it? Yeah, all right. Oh, you sure sound very pretty to us. Beautiful voices you got. His father's bread started down the road, started down the road. All he had and started down the road. That in this world where God only knows, and that'll be the way he'll get along. Well, a poor boy spent all he had, family come in the land, family come in the land. Spent all he had and family come in the land. See, I believe I'd go and hire me to some man, and that'd be the way I'll get along. For to feed my swine, give me a job. For to feed my swine, and the man stood there, hung his head and cried, 'cause that ain't the way for him to get along. Say, I believe I'll ride, believe I'll go back home, believe I'll go back home, believe I'll ride, believe I'll go back home. Down this road as far as I can go. Yeah. See my son coming home to me, coming home to me. The father ran and fell down on his knees. Yeah, sing a prayer, the Lord have mercy on me. Mercy! Oh, well, the father said to the eldest son, kill the fatted calf, call the family around, go kill that calf. Call the family around. My son was lost, now he is found. And that's the way for us to get along. All right. You got to move, child. You got to move.
is when the law gets ready. You got the move. You may be high, you may be low, you may be a rich child, you may be poor, but when the law gets ready, you got to move.
Highly unlikely that the audience that was watching that performance would know what that song was. It was not yet released by the Rolling Stones. That was would be released on their upcoming studio album, Sticky Fingers, the one that would be named Sticky Fingers, their next album. Although the song did, of course, exist as a blues song, but this is how America was learning the blues. We had bands like the Rolling Stones to thank for turning us on to some of this stuff and making us want to dig back through record crates and find some of the original stuff.
Right.
It's also worth thinking about how much had changed since the Stones had last toured the United States. If you put it in perspective, I mean, the last time the Stones were here was in 1966. And then all the drug busts and the mess and Brian dying and the whole, so much went wrong. I mean, they had toured the States about six times in 3 years. And then all of a sudden, another 3 years pass and there's nothing. And then here they are coming back finally in 1969.
Amazing they got back into the country, really.
Right. That was the main problem. In fact, they were originally figuring that they had to basically let Brian know that he wasn't going to be able to tour with them. So that was the original idea about getting Brian out of the band because Brian had drug busts galore.
He would never be able to get a visa.
Yeah, his were going to go away, so they were going to have to do the tour without him anyway. And so they were going to ask him to quit the band or to leave the band, which he was happy to do, but in his death made the whole point moot. But when you think about it, 66 versus 69, the difference is unbelievable, really. I mean, in 1966, the Beatles were still touring.
Right.
You know, the Beatles were playing it. And think of what the audiences were like. We still had screaming girls. When the Stones did their shows in 1966, they were about 20 minutes long.
Right.
If they got to the end.
Right.
And it was just, you know, unbelievably raucous noise. At this point in time now, the Stones are able to play for a good hour and a half. And they're able to actually stop in the middle of the show and perform acoustic blues. And the audience is listening. What happened? I mean, it's unbelievable what happened as far as the American audience went. At first, the Stones thought that there was a problem. In fact, let me read again. This is again from the same book. The Stones now found themselves in a musical landscape that had grown and changed dramatically since their previous tour. In 1966, they would go on stage in front of roiling, screaming fans and generally rush off in 20 minutes. Often, they couldn't hear themselves play. 1969 was the first time that an audience listened, remembers Bill Wyman, the bass player. Not only did they listen, but they spent at least part of the time sitting down. At first, we were worried that we had lost the energy from the audience. But we were always good on stage, so we were able to quite easily deal with it. The fact is that, you know, the Woodstock Nation had grown up.
Right.
We had grown up with our artists. So these people, the original fans that were probably 13, 14, 15, maybe 16...
They're now a little bit more mature now.
16 to 21.
They can sit in a chair.
Right. Politically motivated, politically involved, probably getting stoned. all of these things on probably cause you to be a lot quieter. I mean, it's a lot different if you're getting high compared to getting, like, you know, drunk when you're underage. So all that violence began to be channeled into something very different. It was that whole youth movement. It's why we actually did believe in it for a short bit. The fact that the Stones are at the center point of a lot of that energy is kind of weird, and that's what we'll be talking about, Altamont, and how that all pretty much is eviscerated all at one time. But we'll save most of those stories for next week. Meanwhile, let's play a couple of the band tracks that were excised from the album Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, but eventually released in the 40-year anniversary edition. We'll pick up with the track I'm Free. All right, I've got one more non-LP track that I could be playing that was, you know, placed on the special disc, but I'm going to save that for next week when we discuss Altamont, because that track that I'm not playing is actually Under My Thumb, and as I recall it, that was the track that the Stones were playing at Altamont when the murder actually took place.
Oh.
So it only makes sense to basically hold back on that until we cover that in depth. Now, for that instance, let me also mention at this point in time, first of all, remind you, you're listening to WHPC 90.3 FM, coming to you from Nestor Community College in Garden City, New York. I'm Tom Ryan, Heidi Morales-Ryan, my co-host. We are here every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6 p.m. If you're into the show, and maybe you've if you're a Stones fan and you've been listening to this entire series, or maybe you've missed a couple of them and you want to catch up, you can do that really easy.
Gaps.
Really, we post all of our shows on our website. So if you just go on the internet and you look for AmericanHitNetwork.com, or even just search on American Hit Radio, we ought to be the very first thing that comes up. And you'll see our Wednesday show on the left side of the homepage. Our Friday show is on the right side. And the newest shows, the most recent shows, are posted right there. You should be looking right at them, and you can just click on them to open them up and play them. If you want to go back a little bit and hear from the beginning, you just click on See All. And you'll get this drop-down menu that'll walk you through the entire How Music Changed series, which at this point in time, I believe, constitutes over 300 radio programs.
Wow.
It's incredible. We could really ruin your life if you really wanted
to. If you let us.
If you let us. And that's not even talking about the Wednesday show, which has got just as much, if not more. So keep that in mind if you'd like to. Meanwhile, with the time we've got left, what I would like to do is play a couple of the tracks that were off of the actual Get Your Ya-Ya's Out album. So you could get this on the standard record, which has been out since 1970 when it came out as a tour souvenir. Let's play first from that album, perhaps this track. This is, again, Mick Jagger at his absolute most lascivious, bad boy worst, performing Stray Cat Blues live.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for letting us eat up another hour of your lives. It was a pleasure to do it. At least we had some great music to do it with. We will be back next week as we talk about the Rolling Stones live tour and, of course, the tragic ending of that tour. Really not just an event which was, you know, relevant to the Rolling Stones. It really was relevant to our entire culture, to what was happening with us as a generation. And in that way, I think it's remarkably important. So we'll be covering all of that next week for part 24 of the Rolling Stones coverage as we finish the album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. Meanwhile, that leaves us with one track to play then. I will leave you with this song from the album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, Love in Vain. Hope to see y'all next week. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Two lights on behind.